major companies have invested approximately $2 billion a year on average to kind of maintain where they are. I think that's a good base level starting point to say, what are you going to jump up to?
Governor Parnell sets goals for his oil tax overhaul. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage denies a referendum petition to overturn the controversial union ordinance.
You cannot address administrative matters by referendum.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com.
A review has cleared two Anchorage police officers involved in a fatal shooting. Police spokeswoman Danny Myron says in a release that the Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals ruled that the use of force by officers Roger Billette and Alan Rydberg was within legal parameters and no charges will be filed. On February 19th, Billette and Rydberg shot and killed 25-year-old Carl Richard Bowie III as he drove a stolen vehicle toward them. Police at the time said the two officers fired a total of 7 shots at Bowie. Bowie was struck 3 times and died at the scene. A female passenger in the stolen truck was not injured. The Write In Nick Mo campaign has announced they will not challenge the results of the Anchorage municipal election in West Anchorage's District 3. Thousands of voters wrote in Mo's name on the ballot, but even after a hand count, election officials say Mo lost by more than 500 votes. Also today, Anchorage attorneys denied an application to hold a referendum repealing the controversial ordinance that limits unions and inspired Mo to jump into the race. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Union leaders applied to hold a referendum on the controversial ordinance called AO37 on April 3rd. Municipal Attorney Dennis Wheeler explains the application didn't meet the technical requirements, but he says there was a bigger issue too.
You cannot address administrative matters by referendum.
Wheeler argues the matter is administrative because it deals with issues like where certain employees are located during work, the number of health benefit programs that employees can choose from, and the time frame in which the collective bargaining process should take place. Union leaders applied to hold the referendum the day after municipal elections, when voters turned out in numbers to protest the ordinance at the ballot box. Several thousand filled in the name of write-in candidate Nick Mo instead of voting for Ernie Hall, who was running unopposed in West Anchorage's District 3. Hall chairs the assembly and oversaw passage of the ordinance. Under his leadership, a public hearing was closed before everyone who showed up had a chance to testify. Andy Holloman is the president of the Anchorage Education Association. He was the primary sponsor of the application for a referendum. He does not agree with Wheeler's analysis.
The charter suggests that citizens can reverse an ordinance enacted by the assembly, and that's what we want to do. We think it's about that straightforward. If you have to go to court to get the right to do that, we're prepared to take that action.
Holloman says before filing a lawsuit, he and other union leaders plan to submit a new application to hold a referendum in an effort to remedy technical problems with their previous application. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Now that a bill lowering taxes on oil companies has passed, the big question is, will it work? With the legislative session over, APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that politicians have different opinions on how the new tax regime should be judged.
At a press conference on Monday, Governor Sean Parnell named a few indicators that might suggest whether his bill is succeeding. He says he expects to see changes to Alaska's level of oil production within the next 3 years, and that his administration is basing its budget outlook on the idea that oil companies will add a handful of rigs to legacy fields. Parnell says his administration will also be watching the amount of money that producers put toward capital expenditures.
The major companies have invested approximately $2 billion a year on average to kind of maintain where they are. I think that's a good base level starting point to say, what are you going to jump up to? What are you going to bump up to?
But beyond that, Parnell didn't provide much in the way of concrete metrics for judging his oil tax policy. He stayed away from defining success in specific terms, and he also avoided offering a hard timeline for evaluating his bill. Parnell also tried to temper expectations for his legislation, saying he didn't expect to see dramatic growth in oil production immediately. Democratic legislators have criticized Parnell for not offering clearer benchmarks. Senator Hollis French of Anchorage says they also worry the administration might count projects that are already scheduled to go online as new investment.
So we're going to be watching, we're going to be measuring, and when they start having those ribbon cuttings and the brass bands and the big hullabaloos over new things happening on the North Slope, we're going to remind the public these were already planned.
The new tax structure is scheduled to go into effect in 2014. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The legislature adjourned Sunday without acting on a bill adding new voter identification requirements. But the measure is poised for action when lawmakers return to the Capitol next January. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
House Bill 3 was strongly opposed by a number of Southeast leaders, including lawmakers and Native officials. It passed out of the House Judiciary Committee last week. But when lawmakers adjourned, it remained in the Rules Committee, the last stop before bills go before the full chamber. At one of the measure's final hearings, Alaska Native Brotherhood Grand Camp President Bill Martin said a photo ID requirement could keep people from casting ballots.
There are many people who are my age group that actually don't have ID cards. The ID card is not required when we go for health care at search, or to vote in our tribal elections, because we have our own cards with no picture on them.
Tlingit Haida Central Council, the House Bush Caucus, Juneau's legislative delegation, and some other groups also oppose the legislation. Alaska Native Sisterhood Camp 70 President Jan Trigg went a step further. She said the measure discriminates against rural Alaskans and others.
It creates an impediment to the most basic democratic practice as citizens. The homeless, the homebound, returning veterans, the elderly, people of color, and college students would all be vulnerable to this new law.
The voter ID bill was praised by Travis Lewis, vice president of the group Alaskans for Alaska. He said weak laws have inflated voter rolls in his hometown of Elfin Cove, and he challenged the claim that proper identification is hard to get.
As a veteran, I want to say that when I got out of the military, I had all kinds of ID on me. It's pretty hard for me to understand in this day and age how a person could not have proper identification.
Sponsor Bob Lynn of Anchorage said his bill gives voters several options, including presenting no ID and casting a question ballot.
Nothing in this bill would restrict anybody who's currently registered to vote and motivated to vote from voting, wherever they live in the state, whether it's in an urban area, rural area, on an island, or wherever.
No companion legislation has been introduced in the Senate. That puts the focus on Lynn's bill next year. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Homer novelist Dana Stabenow is plotting to build a new women's-only writer's retreat in her backyard.
I want to get back to the writing community. All the writers who have helped me over the years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
An Army MP has been sentenced to 16 years in prison for espionage. 24-year-old William Colton Millay had pleaded guilty in March of this year to charges of attempted espionage, issuing false statements, and communicating national defense information with intent to harm the U.S. In an all-day court-martial proceeding at Jaybird yesterday, FBI special agent and witness for the prosecution Derek Criswell relayed a bizarre story of how Millay had worked unknowingly with an FBI informant whom the soldier thought was a Russian spy. Malay's interactions with the informant involved a dead drop or anonymous drop of classified information at a well-known Anchorage park and clandestine meetings at a Midtown restaurant. FBI agents had Malay under surveillance and seized the classified information as evidence, and in a later setup, watched as Malay collected $3,000 and a new cell phone that he has asked the so-called spy to pay him. Defense Attorney Charles Swift says the government could have stopped the sting any time.
This was a case where we looked long and hard at the defense of entrapment. The legal elements of it weren't there. In the end, he pled guilty. He's taken responsibility. But this is not a case where I think we, the United States, hold up and say, wow, we're so much better off. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for this family. It's a tragedy for the base. It's a tragedy for him. It's a tragedy for everyone involved.
Swift says his client has undergone psychological evaluation and experts have found Malay to be emotionally immature.
I think that the hardest part is Malay as a five-year-old. Sometimes as a five-year-old in behavior, you know, these things aren't real. They never were real in his head, and that's certainly a question in it. But I think what was most devastating for him was to see the impact on his father, to see the impact on his parents, who, you know, despite an extraordinarily dysfunctional family, he loved and does love.
But other witnesses for the prosecution detailed how damaging Malay's sale of classified military information could be. Marine Major General Timothy Hennepin said certain aspects of the information Malay revealed pertain to deterrence the U.S. military has to electronically detonate improvised explosive devices. In military court, an 8-man panel of military officers voted on Malay's 16-year sentence. Swift said a pretrial plea bargain helped reduce the sentence. Former Juneau Mayor Bill Overstreet is being remembered as a persuasive and successful spokesman for Alaska's capital city during the Capitol Move fights of the 70s and 80s. Overstreet died last week in Sun City West, Arizona, where he and his wife Jean have spent their winters in recent years. He was 86 years old. Bill moved his family from Oklahoma to Juneau in 1952. Over the years, he was a teacher, school administrator, and became the first director of the statewide Alaska School Board Association. As KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports, it was his work as a Juneau crusader that most recall.
Bill Overstreet was first elected to the Juneau Assembly in 1973, after Alaskans had voted to relocate the capital to an undetermined place. A capital selection committee was tasked with picking three sites, and in 1976, voters chose Willow. That was the year Overstreet was elected mayor. Rich Poor was on the assembly then. He calls Overstreet a strong mayor during a time when the capital move dwarfed all other issues in Juneau.
There was quite a battle that went right up to the mid-80s to keep the seat in Juneau. So it was definitely a dominating time in Juneau.
Alaska was spread across four time zones then. Poor says one of the mayor's biggest accomplishments was leading the charge toward one time zone, which was a major issue for capital move proponents.
One of the things that was always a complaint with the Anchorage people in particular was that Juneau was always 2 hours ahead of them. So you could only get 5 hours of business conducted during the day instead of the normal 7 hours, 7.5 hours.
But changing time zones was not a popular idea in Juneau, and it almost cost the mayor his seat.
There was recall efforts and all kinds of things that tried to stop him and whatnot. So, I mean, it was pretty heroic on his part to get her done, so to say.
By 1983, Alaska's most populated areas had turned their clocks, and all but a small segment of the Aleutian Islands remains on one time zone. During those years, Overstreet was probably the most effective spokesman for the capital city.
He was just a very effective speaker and very articulate, and told our story probably better than any have before and since.
When Greening also was part of the efforts to save the Capitol, then and now, Greening describes Overstreet as calm and reasonable when he spoke.
He's just a very believable, honest person.
Juneau's loudest foe was Bill Atwood, publisher of the now-defunct Anchorage Times. His bully pulpit was his statewide newspaper, which lobbied continuously to move the Capitol. Overstreet was willing to take him on.
Bill Overstreet went to the Lion's Den in Anchorage and faced him and used his humor to really get his points across.
Clark Greening was raised in Juneau but living in Anchorage then, representing a district in the Alaska legislature. He says Overstreet's humor in two major debates helped put a different face on Capitol move arguments. At the time, Jim Clark was chairman of the group dubbed Keeping the Capitol in Juneau. It was the forerunner of the Alaska Committee. He very clearly recalls that chamber debate where Atwood compared the proximity of the Capitol to the people to a farmer and his barn.
And he said, when the farmer has his house, he wants the barn to be close to his house. And Bill stood up and said, that's just the trouble with your thinking, Atwood. It ain't your barn.
The showdown came in 1982 when Alaskans would vote for a $2.8 billion bond issue to cover some of the costs of moving the Capitol to Willow. Before that election, Overstreet described the choice Alaskans could make in this interview for the statewide television program Alaska Review.
And we think that as soon as people began to relate to the fact that they could either have their taxes lowered or they could have their own communities improved or they can build a new city for the bureaucrat, there's no doubt in my mind but what they're going to say, well, let's fix up all of Alaska. Let's not just fix up new houses, new buildings, new schools for the people that work for government. Let's see if we can't provide some of these benefits to those who are governed.
Alaskans turned down that 1982 bond issue. Jim Clark credits Overstreet for building goodwill for Juneau throughout the state and making it possible for the capital city to win that election. A memorial for Bill Overstreet is being planned for July. In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
Alaska author Dana Stabenow has big plans, and they have nothing to do with the plot of her next crime fiction novel. Stabenow hopes to turn her 10-acre property outside of Homer into a writer's retreat dedicated to fostering the skills of female writers. KBBI's Aaron Selbig visited with Stabenow and has this report.
Dana Stabenow's house is at the end of a narrow, snowy road on the outskirts of Homer.
Hi, Aaron.
Oh, hello there.
Hi.
How are you?
She's invited me over today to show me her property, 10 acres on a gently sloping hill with a breathtaking view of Lower Cook Inlet, Augustine Volcano, and Mount Iliamna. It's here where Stabenow plans to build Story Knife, Alaska's first writer's retreat reserved only for female writers. The inspiration for Story Knife came from an experience Stabenow had years ago. When her writing career was just beginning, one of her first rewards was a residency at Hedgebrook Farm, a writer's retreat for women on Whidbey Island in Puget Sound.
It was 2 weeks of, I don't know how else to say this, it's not hyperbole, it is heaven on earth for a writer. There are six cabins and a main house, and you spend all day in your cabin writing, and in the evening you come together with your fellow residents and talk shop.
Stabenow says Hedgebrook Farm was not just a beautiful, isolated retreat conducive to getting some serious writing done, although it certainly was that. She says her experience there was the first time that anyone treated writing like a real job. 20 years and 29 published novels later, when she bought her house, with its adjoining acreage, its solitude, and its inspiring view, she began to dream about the possibilities.
I thought for some time, wouldn't it be nice to build a Hedgebrook Farm North, essentially? And so I've been thinking about it and dreaming about it and thinking, I'd love that to be my legacy. But it didn't really become possible until I published 16 out-of-print books as ebooks and was able to pay off my house in 9 months. And I thought, okay, I don't have the mortgage anymore. Where can I put that money? And the answer was Story Knife.
The first step is to come up with the money to build Story Knife, which Stabenow estimates will be in the neighborhood of $1 million. To help accomplish that, she set up a website, storyknife.org, to crowdsource donations and help spread the word. The ultimate goal is a $20 million endowment, which will ensure the long-term stability of the nonprofit organization that will run Story Knife. Stabenow has skin in the game, too, beyond the donation of her property. She set up a living trust for Story Knife that will forever receive all proceeds from her intellectual property. Writers would come to Story Knife for 2 to 8 week residencies to focus on their writing projects in uninterrupted peace. She envisions the retreat as a collection of 6 small cabins and a main house, all built on her Homer property.
Hedgebrook Farm is the only writer's retreat, not just in the nation, but in the world, for women. And that's 6 cabins. For all the aspiring women authors in the world, that's not enough. And, you know, 6 more isn't enough either, but it's what I can do. The whole point is they're here to write.
Right.
That's it. That's all.
No cooking, no washing dishes.
No. They're not going to wash so much as a teacup. No. They don't get to do that.
Okay.
They write. That's it.
Stabenow says that the big reason she's doing this now is that after years of success, she feels an urge to contribute, to help foster the next generation of women writers.
Kachemak Bay made me. I was raised in Seldovia. I live in Homer now. I want to give back to the community. I want to give back to the writing community. The writers, all the writers who have helped me over the years. I can't do nothing if I have the power to do something.
So what exactly is a Story Knife, and how did Stabenow come up with that name? She says she found the term when researching at Anchorage's Lusac Library for her book Dead in the Water, the 3rd Kate Shugak novel. Story Knife takes its name from the English translation for the Yupik word, Yaaruin.
Young Yupik girls would have story knives made for them by their older male relatives. The story knives would be made out of bone or ivory or wood. And they would take these story knives down to the river along with their younger siblings, and they would carve stories in the riverbanks.
Stabenow still carries her own story knife. It was made for her by an Aleut artist and presented to her by a close friend 20 years ago, right before she won the 1993 Edgar Award for Best Paperback Original. It's a concept that is obviously very important to her and one that she hopes to carry into the future long after she's gone. Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
A dog took the stage during this year's Alaska Folk Festival. So did a drum and pipe band and some Middle Eastern-style singers and dancers. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld assembled this audio postcard.
Well, I found a Gidgin's Bible by my bed one night in a hotel in a town I can't recall.
I'm Tom Begich from Anchorage, Alaska.
What brings you down to the Folk Festival so many years?
Oh, ever since the first time I came back in 1983, I've just loved it, you know, and I haven't been at every folk fest since then, but I've been to many of them. I think I didn't play until 87 was the first time I actually played.
Any special place the folk festival holds in your music regime, so to speak?
Year after year after year here, I have introduced new songs. I tend to put them with some of my older songs, too, so that people can have a flavor. But I like to test the audience to see how they react, you know, and it's a pretty generous audience.
Do you play other festivals?
I play all over the country, so I mean, there's a whole list of folks and places that I play, but I mostly tour from May to June in the Southwest and Midwest, and then I go to the East Coast and the Central States. Generally, though, I prefer house concerts. There's just a more appreciative audience. You get to meet everybody. But it's weird because the Folk Fest is like a big house concert. Yeah.
You cannot change your future. Your past is lost in time. One moment changing everything for good. There are no words of comfort. Peace to soothe my soul, just the echo of a life misunderstood.
I'm Beth.
I'm Sherry.
And I'm Patricia.
And I'm Susanna Lessard.
So, what about the name? Where does Noodle of Doom come from?
Well, you know, people say, oh, we were just noodling around. Well, we noodle around. And that doom, that's that bass note on the doom back. That big boom.
Is it difficult singing in another language?
Yes, it is. Roma is not a standard language. It's an amalgamation of lots of languages because it's a traveling people. So it's not like I could actually study any diction lessons on Roma. I had to just try to listen to it, and they like to sing fast.
What's the general experience being up there dancing to this music?
It's fun, and when you can't really see the entire crowd, it's even better. But when you see a couple of friendly faces in front, it makes it easier.
Do you ever have people walk up to you a couple days after you perform and say, "I didn't know you did that"?
Yeah.
And what do you tell them if they ask?
Whatever they want to know. And when the next class is.
Why don't I first have you introduce yourself?
Toad.
Coyote.
And would you mind saying what your other names are?
Tiffany.
Steven.
So tell me about the name of the band.
It's our names put together.
Our nicknames.
Our nicknames
mind
put
you.
Together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That we've had since we were little.
So is this your first folk festival?
It is indeed.
First time being here, first time playing. It's awesome.
Well, tell me about the music you're playing. Original tunes, old style tunes?
No, it's a whole mix. The ones we played tonight are more old style ones, you know, old time tunes. We put our own little flair on, or fiddle tunes or whatever, but we play some jazz songs and other contemporary songs and some songs that
reggae.
Tiffany's written, and reggae songs as well.
But tonight was definitely more for the whole spirit of folk and family, and just coming from a family of ranchers in the Midwest and keeping that alive.
Mom had down the track with the chicken on my back. Soles of my feet are nearly gone.
Wore out.
And up the road ahead, there's an old farmer ship. That's where I'll rest my weary.
That was an audio postcard from this year's Alaska Folk Festival, produced by Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Register now for the 2013 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, May 2nd and 3rd at the Dena Center in Anchorage. This fifth annual conference offers participants an unmatched opportunity to network with national industry experts and learn the latest on policies, programs, and projects in the clean energy industry. Online registration ends on April 26th. More information at www.bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP, your voice for renewable energy. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.